Welcome back to the next installment, Bible Study at the Beginning of the World. Hope you're well. We last ended on Mark 5:20, looking at the man with the legion of demons, the Roman demons, who, as his mark of discipleship, was sent to preach. He was given a voice, the lowest of the low, given a voice to go and speak to the Decapolis, the Gentile regions. So he was a disciple of Jesus who is sent now to proclaim to the Gentile regions. Jesus has shown his authority over Jewish demons and spheres of influence and Jewish illnesses and Jewish relationships, and now he's showing his authority over Roman relationships and Gentile diseases and Gentile demons. And then Mark puts the geography back into the world of the Jesus' people, and Jesus crossed again to the other side. So Mark is always moving Jesus around. This, like I've said many times, the image here is there's constant movement. It's really dynamic. Jesus is always moving. He's marching across the land, showing his authority over various contested spheres of influence, and bringing people out of those spheres and whatever binds them, and then forming them around himself. And so now he's gone back to the other side, so back to the Jewish land, and a great crowd gathers around him, the great oklos, the unwashed masses. Verse 22, then came one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. Seeing him, he fell at his feet and implored him earnestly, saying, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come and lay your hands on her so that she may be made well and live." Okay. Verse 24, and Jesus went with him. So, Jairus. So first of all, ruler of a synagogue. Jairus is not an oklos, okay? He's an elite, and he's running a synagogue. So, first of all, he's not one of the illiterate mob. And he's showing, well, the illiterate mob would have seen someone like Jairus, not so much as a figure of honor. You know, there'd be a sense that he would almost be an enemy here. There's a lot of class resentment against rulers of synagogues and against the oklos. The oklos are considered unclean, even though they're Jewish. And there was antagonism here. This isn't a great happy family here. The other thing about Jairus as a synagogue ruler is, frankly, to be of that status, to have an elite status, to hold open synagogues is in some ways to hint, or there are suggestions that, you know, you'd have to be colluding with Rome in some way. You have to collude with the powers that be in some way to keep these things open. So Jairus is in a way, he's a bit of he's part of a social class that, if you read from below, remember, if you don't read from above, if you don't read these Gospels as yourselves members of the elite, if you read it from below, you see Jairus and his ilk as, in some ways, the enemy, part of the oppressive class. And Jairus comes, and he falls at Jesus' feet. Jairus is showing real bravery here. He's not moving in a circle where he is welcome. And he comes into the oklos. He makes himself unclean, and he's being willing to be seen to be with Jesus. So Jairus is showing bravery, and he's showing faith. He's not ashamed of Jesus, and he's willing to bring shame on his own set of inherited privileges. And he sees Jesus, and he falls at his feet, and he implores him earnestly, "My little daughter is at the point of death. Come, lay your hands on her." Now this girl, she's the daughter, she's a virgin daughter. We're told later on that she's 12 years old. She's the virgin daughter of an elite man who's a ruler of a synagogue. And women would have to have a man to speak for them. They didn't have a voice of their own. So here's the man doing what you should do. He's speaking for his daughter. He's seeking help for her. And in some ways, she's the highest of the high. Right, she's pure, rich, elite, synagogue, family, and has a man to speak for her. And now here's some movement, verse 24, and Jesus went with him. So now a great crowd followed him and thronged about him. All right? So there's movement here. This great crowd swilling about. Jairus comes, and Jesus starts to move towards the girl. And the crowd is moving with him. And now what happens? Verse 25, there was a woman who had a discharge of blood for 12 years, and who had suffered much under many physicians, and had spent all that she had, and was no better, but grew worse. All right, we've just met the highest of the high, and now we're going to meet the opposite. Obviously, in Jewish purity laws of the first century here, there was different levels of what made you impure, different levels of association. And a Jewish man could speak to another Jewish man, which was fine. Next level down, a Jewish man interacting with a Jewish woman. Next level down, a Jewish man associating with a Gentile. That would make you less clean. Associating with an animal makes you unclean. Associating with a dead animal is even worse. And underneath that was associating with a menstruating woman. Menstruating women were less clean than dead animals. And here comes an oklos. She's a menstruating woman. Not only that, she is poor and has been abused by, suffered much under many physicians. And the idea here, it's not so much, some of the language being used, it's not so much that she, these physicians were trying their best to help her. They are exploiting her. She's been defrauded, or her money's been taken from her, and she's unclean. She's in a state of absolute chronic uncleanliness, impurity, cast from all networks and family and social fellows that are going to help her. She is the lowest of the low, probably the lowest person we meet in Mark's gospel. There's another one coming up, but I think this woman might be the lowest, least human person we meet. When everyone looked at her, they did not see a human being. And she hears the reports about Jesus, and she comes up behind him in the crowd and touches his garment. She comes forth out of the crowd and touches his garment. For she said, if I touch the garments, I will be made well. Verse 29, here comes this word again. Immediately, the flow of blood dried up, and she felt that she was healed. And Jesus, perceiving in himself that power had gone out from him, immediately turns around and in the crowd and says, who touched my garments? So there's movement here. The crowd is all moving towards this girl to be healed. Everybody's expecting it. And then along comes the lowest of the low, a less than human person. And she touches Jesus' cloak. And what does he do? He stops. He stops the movement. What is the first implication, or who's the first victim of this act? What happens to the little girl? She dies. The whole world is moving towards the highest of the high. Everybody's expecting her to be healed. Along comes a less than human woman with menstrual problems and gullible poverty. And Jesus stops everything for her. And the first consequence is that the little girl dies. And then he feels power going out of him, which everybody always asks me about that. And I'll be honest, I don't really know. There's some other places where Jesus, where power comes out of him, but I don't really know what that means. It's just he something happens and he knows that this woman has touched him. Now, what does Jesus do? In perceiving in himself, he says, who touched me? And his disciples said to him, you see this oklos pressing around you, and yet you say, who touched me? Now, a lot of people say, oh, when the woman touched Jesus, he was made unclean. Well, he was unclean a long time before she came to him, because the crowd was pressing around him. But in any case, he looks around. Now, we have met Jesus, who has, he's able to see inside people's hearts. He's able to still any opposition with his authoritative, clever words. He's able to tell teaching and parables that astound the crowd. And now we meet him where he says, who touched me? Is this because Jesus doesn't actually know? I don't think so. I don't think this is what... This makes a nonsense of the person we've met so far in the Gospel of Mark. But what happens is he looks around. Verse 33, the woman, knowing what had happened to her, comes in fear and trembling and falls down and tells him the whole truth. What we have is a story of somebody who is now forced to own her own actions. She's had to come forward. This is an example of Jesus is putting a face to the faceless. He's giving a voice to the voiceless. Anybody looking at her would not have seen a human being. And now, because he asked this question, she's being forced to own herself and have a voice. And sometimes you might think, oh, is he humiliating her in this moment? Is he making her a figure of public shame? Do you know, it's the exact opposite. He has now created a human where before there was no human seen. He's just created a person who has a voice and an identity and who's responsible for her own actions. She says the whole truth, 34, and he says to her, daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. The first thing Jesus says is daughter. Remember, the little girl has a man to speak for her. She has her father to speak for her. Everything's going for her the way it should go because she has a family. And what Jesus does in this moment is he extends his mantle over this woman and he says, daughter. He makes her a member of his family. He's now speaking for her. He gives her a name and an identity. Daughter, your faith, your willingness to be seen to be with me, to come out of the crowd, to step forward has made you well. Go in peace. There's that word again. And be healed of your disease. The story here is not so... Jesus has healed a lot of people so far. This isn't the news in this bit of this chapter 5. The amazing thing here is not that a person gets healed. We've already met that. The amazing thing here is what he's done to the priority of the crowd and the priority of who matters and who's seen to matter. What the amazing thing is that Jesus has just created a human being where before no one saw one. Daughter, your faith has made you well. And by calling her daughter, by the way, he also shows faith in her. He shows willingness to be seen to be with her. He shows allegiance to her. So Jesus extends faith to her and he commends her for her faith to him. But then, just to show that he's not running some sort of class war of the poor killing the rich and the oklos getting what's theirs back against the corrupt ruling classes, he's going to go and heal the rich girl as well. While he was speaking, there came from the ruler's house some who said, your daughter is dead. Why trouble the teacher any further? But overhearing what they said, Jesus says to the ruler of the synagogue, do not fear, only believe. Don't go with them, come with me. And he allowed no one to follow him, except Peter and James and John, the brother of James. So, listen, he's not starting a movement based on popularity and signs and wonders. Jesus is once again deliberately putting a boundary around who can see this. He's not doing this for everybody. He's running away from the power of the popular crowd. I think I must have mentioned before, this is one of the popular crowd or the wave of adulation, the people swarming over the hillsides in order to see miracles and experience signs and wonders. This is one of the groups that Jesus needs to put the brakes on. This is one of the groups that needs the messianic secret. They need to be re-educated of what a Messiah is. And one of the ways Jesus re-educates them is by not letting them see what they think they want to see. So he allows no one to follow him, and they come to the house of the ruler of the synagogue, where there's people weeping and wailing. And he says, why are you weeping? The child's not dead, but sleeping. And they laughed at him. Now, wouldn't you think this would be a great opportunity to rub their noses in it and say, "You laughing, you mockers, come have a look at what I'm going to do." But he doesn't do that. He puts them outside. And he's only with the people who've already shown faith. The people of peace, the ruler, the synagogue ruler, and the disciples who are with him, those are the ones he keeps with him. Jesus is not throwing his pearl to swine. He says, don't, when you go into a village, don't seek out the people of peace. He says, don't stay with people who reject you. And Jesus does this here. He's with the people of peace, and he does the miracle just for them. Taking her by the hand, he says to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, arise." And immediately the girl gets up and begins walking. And now we get the little sting in the tail, for she was 12 years of age. And they were immediately overcome with amazement. And once again, messianic secret, he strictly charged them that no one should know this, and told them to give her something to eat. Your Bibles might have some sort of headline here where the story is called, mine says, "Jesus heals a woman and Jairus's daughter." And I think it's much more accurately described. If you really must put in some sort of chapter break or some sort of heading, commentators have said this is much better described as the healing of two daughters. That Jesus makes one daughter out of this woman and he heals another daughter. And he does so in a way that shows he is an agent of creation, that shows that he has authority over spirits and illness, that shows that he is not beholden to the crowd and its expectations, and it shows that he's not trying to make and create a movement based on the adulation and amazement of the crowd. In fact, he rebuffs it and finds ways to get around it at every point. He strictly charged them that no one should know, and he told them to give her something to eat. I think I might stop there. That seems as good a place as any to stop. And we're going to get to the beginning of chapter 6 in the next episode. Bless you, friends. Keep those questions coming. I have two interludes coming up in which I address some questions and comments that have been coming to me that aren't strictly about the Gospel of Mark, and that people have asked me to speak a little bit further on some of the issues that are coming up. So the next two sessions are going to be optional. And if you care about Satan and sons of God, or if you care about the idea of two eras and the kingdom of God and the kingdom of man and how this might relate to the wrath of God, the judgment of God, and indeed, dare I say, the coronavirus, well, then you can listen to the next two interludes. But if you don't care about that stuff, do wait for a bit, and we will carry on with Mark chapter 6 shortly. Until then, as I say, stay safe and stay sane. And we'll talk to you soon.